Hello and welcome to Tech Shock from Parents Own, the podcast that looks at the impact of digital technologies on family life for parents, teachers, professionals and policymakers, with me, Vicky Shotbolt, and Geraldine Bedell.
In this week's podcast, we talk to Callum Hood, Head of Research at the Centre for Countering Digital Hate. We focus on the CCDH's recent report into incels, who exist in an enclosed world of creative language and violent misogyny.
We talked to Callum about how young men are drawn into this world and how its strange assumptions about attractiveness are spreading beyond the manosphere. Callum explains how hatred of older women who have low sexual currency, according to incels, but still won't sleep with them, leads to the sexual abuse of pubescent girls. It's a grim and sad culture, but a very interesting listen.
How are you, Vicky?
I'm good. I'm feeling as though we're properly into our stride now with the autumn and getting properly geared up for our conference.
Yes, very soon. And it's very good news that Callum Hood, who is our guest on this week's Tech Shop podcast, is speaking at the conference. That seems like a good point to bring Callum in. Hello, Callum. You're Head of Research at the Centre for Countering Digital Hate.
Yes, yeah. I've been with the Centre for Countering Digital Hate for about 2.5 years now. It's nice to be here with you both.
Thank you for joining us. Now, the CCDH is an organisation that works across the US and the UK, and it's founded by a Brit. Is that right?
That's right. Our CEO is Imran Ahmed, who was a Brit. He's now based in the US with the US side of our organisation. And I remain back here in London.
You've just published a report about incels, and I wonder what made you want to look at incel culture?
Well, the Centre's done a lot of work on misogyny. So we've looked at misogynist abuse of public figures, misogynist abuse sent over Instagram DMs. We've looked at sort of toxic misogynist influencers like Andrew Tate. And incel ideology is interesting in that it's sort of an extreme part of this wider misogynist hole on the internet. So, about sort of a year into the job, I launched a bit of an internal project to sort of try and plumb out what the state of the manosphere is. And I was surprised to find out that, many of the old sort of pickup artists, many of the old red pill and men going their own way, these are sort of all communities which promote misogyny, are still there and they're still very popular and in many cases are on mainstream social media. And then there was a sort of another surprise that incel communities seem to be still out there and still very robust. And then this really took sort of, we were already thinking about this. And then in the UK, we saw this mass shooting in Plymouth, which when we looked into it, we saw had been perpetrated by a young man who himself had been very involved in incel communities, and that that seemed to be a sort of factor in his life. So we decided at that point really that we were going to do further work on this at some point, and we've just assembled a very crack team, including some data researchers. So we wanted to dive into this in a bit more detail.
I think there is so much to dive into. I have a feeling quite a lot of it's going to be a little depressing, to say the least. But before we do dive in, I'd love to hear more about how you did it, because I understand you did it through your new quant lab, your crack team you've just referred to. How did they go about doing this research?
So, some of our new staff, they're very adept at what's called web scraping, which is where you take a website of some kind and then you sort of extract particular bits of data from that web page, typically sort of text or, details of posts, for example, like the date it was posted, the username who posted it, and the text of the post, for example. But you could do all sorts of things in terms of scraping. You could theoretically scrape any bits of data from any website. One of the remarkable things about the incel forum that we studied, and just to say, I'm not going to name it throughout this conversation because we don't want to sort of give it further publicity. But one of the really interesting things about it is that it's almost entirely open to the public. And we think that's a very deliberate choice in order to maximise their ability to bring new people into the forum, but also to try and make sure it's viewable by this wider audience of what's sometimes called lurkers, you know, people who just visit the site but don't actually join up and just read its content and are sort of passive participants in the community. So it was all there open to us, and the, you know, not to make it sound too easy, because I'm sure my talented team went to some great difficulty on it. But there were some challenges in terms of scraping the site. But once those were solved, my team were able to collect 1.2 million posts, which is basically every single post in the main sub-forum from this incel forum since 1st of January 2021. So we got a sort of very complete view of the conversations on there over that 18-month period.
That's a really impressive feat. And I think you found that the forum had very high levels of users. And we associate incels, obviously, with violent misogyny. But I think one of the things that your team found is that there are links with other conspiratorial violent movements as well.
Well, the really interesting thing about this site is that there were two main guys involved in setting it up in, if I recall, 2017. But they went on to set up a number of other forums. So they were instrumental in this, in establishing a forum to do with suicide, which was the subject of a New York Times investigation at the end of last year, which showed that it's implicated in the deaths of lots of young people in the US, and presumably around the world as well, but it was focused on the US. They set up a website to do with body image. So young men who are really, really concerned about how they look, to the point of body dysmorphia in some cases, and recommending some quite extreme solutions to these body image concerns, such as surgery or using performance-enhancing drugs, for example. And then the third and final is a forum concerned with young men who are unemployed. And that gives you a really clear idea of the sorts of young people that they're trying to reach out to, bearing in mind the incel forum in this network was the first one. And we also discovered that there's significant overlap between these other forums with the incel forum when you compare the usernames that are present on each one. And with the exception of the suicide forum I just mentioned, the other three are open to men only. And they share much of the ideology in terms of, or elements of incel ideology in terms of what's discussed there. And this sort of what they call a black pill ideology versus a red pill ideology. Black pill is sort of the incel ideology where you become completely nihilist, completely hopeless about your ability to sort of become a full functioning member of society, which in their view is almost entirely constituted in forming sexual relationships. Whereas the red pill sort of holds open the possibility of, once you awaken to this sort of society, which in their view is skewed against men, that realisation holds within it the seed of being able to sort of overcome or overturn this anti-male society. So it's sort of this entire ecosystem at the core of which sits this black pill, nihilistic, violent incel ideology. And they've developed this entire incelosphere network of sites that acts as a sort of pathways into that incel community.
That's absolutely extraordinary. If I'm understanding correctly, you're describing vulnerable young men, disenfranchised young men, young men who for one reason or another might be drawn into quite dark content around body image and unemployment. I'm really curious to know, the guys that set it up, what was their pathway into it? What's the motivation for them?
The truth is, there's not a whole lot known about them. The New York Times did incredible work last year, and it actually, as a result, I believe, of sort of leaked domain name details and registration details, was able to find out the names and locations of the two men that they believe are most sort of instrumental in setting up this network of sites. They're very defensive about them. They actually have Twitter accounts, which they for a number of these sites in the network, which they use to sort of provide a sort of ideological justification for their existence. They're sort of there on Twitter, sort of, you know, from the very leadership of this site, setting out, you know, a case for incel ideology and a case for the continued existence of these sites, whether that's saying that, you know, mounting a defence of the suicide forum or mounting a defence of the incel forum on the basis that they claim that this thing is the picture like they like to paint is that this is a sort of a support network, but that hasn't been true of incel communities, I thought, most incel or the largest incel communities in quite some time, really. But their real core ideology, their core motivation is largely unknown. I think if you look at what they sort of the leadership of these sites say on Twitter, sort of by their own hand, they are very, very committed to this ideology. So, you know, I think they are sort of true believers in the ideology that they are facilitating in communities for. Some of the sites carry a little bit of advertising. So the Body Image Forum in particular carries advertising. But from what I've seen, I don't think that's a major motivator. I think they probably do raise enough money to keep these sites ticking over and operating and the infrastructure intact. But there's no sign that they're sort of making much more from it than that. So this appears to be a very ideological enterprise.
It's absolutely fascinating. And clearly the ideology is quite complex and it has its own language and it's very, very dark. I think one of the things that you found was that there's a post about rape every 29 minutes and most of the posts about rape are in favour of rape. But from the outside, some incel forums, and I haven't been on the incel forum, I don't think, that you're talking about, but I have looked at them on Reddit and they seem to be ironic or almost funny. Or they add in a video game to the end of posts to make them seem innocuous. And sometimes it seems almost self-mocking. It's a kind of bleak, self-hating humour. But you'd say presumably that they're accomplished at making their hatred look less criminal. I mean, the underlying ideology is actually hateful and self-hating, not kind of self-mocking.
Yes. I mean, we've seen this many times where the, you know, sort of posters of extreme content adopt a sort of ironic or mock humorous tone to try and leave it uncertain to readers or observers just how seriously to take this stuff. But, you know, I think that's what the powerful thing about our report is. It shows just how prevalent discussion of these really extreme topics is. And, you know, it makes it absolutely clear that this is more than, you know, just an attempt to sort of shock people with humour. Bear in mind that this is a sort of fairly self-contained community. It's no longer present, with some exceptions, on mainstream social media platforms as it once was on Reddit. So they're there to sort of develop this ideology with each other. And you can't explain it all away by it being, you know, humour or irony. There's a lot of posts on there that don't contain any humour at all. When you look at the sort of rules of the forum, which are in effect a sort of, you know, the boundaries of this ideology, they don't allow women to join. You know, it's exclusively male. They don't allow anyone who's formed a sexual relationship to join. And then, you know, probably the most startling thing we found during the course of our research was that in March 2022, they actually changed their rules so that instead of reading do not sexualize minors in any way, shape or form, it was changed to do not sexualize prepubescent minors in any way, shape or form. So the sense in which the contours of this thing are very, very deliberate. It's not all just a big joke. And that's before you even get on to the fact that there has been real world harm perpetrated by incels. I mean, there's a bit of a problem, I think, in that news reports often like to characterise these guys as lone wolves, but that ignores the fact that they are part of an online community, a sort of pack of wolves in these in online incel communities that has, you know, helped. You know, what we say is that it's harmful to the young men who join these communities, and then it's harmful to those around them as well. It's a very bleak ideology that it imparts on members of this community. I remember reading posts by the mass shooter in Plymouth in the UK who was part of incel communities, where he himself said that joining incel communities had made his mental health worse and that he wished he'd never become involved with them. So, you know, they can try and explain this stuff away as humour if they like, but the overall point, the overall tone, the overall ideology that's actually being espoused by these supposedly humorous posts is very, very clear and can't be explained away by just saying, oh, well, it's ironic.
Although I'm sure that that's one of the defences that they offer up to challenge. But that shift that you describe to a different attitude towards pubescent versus prepubescent children is really dark and immediately takes my mind to the connections between this community and the community, if that's the right word, of people involved in child sexual abuse online. Do you know where that's coming from? Are the communities growing to such an extent now that they're blending with other harmful communities on the internet?
What I think it stems from is an absolute disregard for the status of women, all women, and a complete disregard for the notion of consent. You know, that's why we've got this statistic in our report. Every 29 minutes rape is mentioned. 89% in discussions of rape say it's legitimate, and 53% in discussions of child abuse say that's legitimate and is acceptable. And I think it's sort of an extension of the idea that women are just subhuman, that there's this resentment, especially for older women, which I think sort of stems from a view that older women have less value because they're less sexually attractive, and therefore it is even more of an affront that these women will not sleep with sexless men, will not sleep with incels. And this sort of perversely leads to a kind of fetishization of younger women, including even girls, teens, as we've discussed, you know, with this rule change, they accepted sexualization of pubescent minors. So I think it stems from that, really. And I think it's this sort of very extreme view that women are there to be degraded and abused, that it's all legitimate.
It is very distressing to listen to this. And actually, there's a kind of language that they use that demeans and dehumanizes women, so that women become kind of non-persons. I'm interested in the extent to which you have any sense of how much suicide is involved. We know about the mass shootings, but are there also a large number of suicides or a significant number of suicides?
It's very hard to tell. I mean, it's outside of the scope of this report to say how many members of the incel forum itself have been involved, you know, have ended their lives with suicide. What we do know is that thanks to that New York Times investigation, which, you know, is incredible and must have taken incredible amounts of work on behalf of the investigative journalists who did it, is that dozens of young people who were members of the Suicide Forum, which is part of this network set up by the same people, dozens have ended their lives. And we know from our own analysis that this is a very bleak place. What are the, you know, so there's a number of defense mechanisms that these the sort of leaders of this incel community like to deploy in its defense. One of them saying it's irony or humour, which just doesn't hold water because it's such a determined attempt to build this ideology. The other is that this is actually a support network. This is good for the young men who join this community. They need to link up with other like-minded men. But when you look at the topics that are under discussion, so one of the interesting things about the forum is that every discussion thread on there has a tag or a label that states what that discussion is about. And when we looked across the data set that we had, it was a third of them were tagged with labels to do with despair or rage. So, for example, the rage fuel tag and the suicide fuel tags are some of the most popular on the forum. If you compare that with life fuel, for example, which is another tag on there, which is supposed to be, you know, discussing reasons to carry on living, the contrast is something like a third of the discussion threads have these rage and despair linked topics, and just 5.8% concern these more sort of optimistic topics such as life fuel. So that's just, we know that from looking at these forums anyway, but that just sort of evidences how strong the skew is in favour of content that deepens despair and rage about the life circumstances of these young men. And I think anyone who goes and looks at the discussions on these forums, it just doesn't hold water to say that this is, young men helping them each other out. In discussions about suicide, I mean, it's often common, and again, they may claim that this is ironic or is humour, but it is such a determined and consistent thing that you can't come away without thinking that this is part of the ideology. They will encourage people to commit suicide. You know, they will encourage people's rage and despair. So, you know, I do have sympathy for young men that are led into these communities, because I think it's a very toxic environment for them to enter into. And that's why we've said to some of the, you know, big social media platforms like Google and YouTube, where there are in various ways footholds that incels have on those mainstream platforms, that we really need those mainstream platforms to do something about that, because we want to try and prevent young men from being led down these routes into the incel community, whether it's because they're concerned about their body image or because they're depressed or suicidal. This is a bad place for them to go. This is the worst possible help and advice that they could get.
It's really interesting to hear you talk about that support network defence, because it's exactly the same one that a Meta executive used recently at the Molly Russell inquest. I'm sure that there is a case there that is correct, that there are circumstances in which support is found in networks that talk about suicide. But context is all, isn't there, and content and clearly, I mean, your report memorably describes the culture as soaked in anger and despair. There's a huge difference between a supportive forum and one that's soaked in anger and despair. I wonder, what do you think the responsibility of tech is? And, you know, just to be clear, it's not just a tech problem, is it? It's a problem with attitudes towards women. What needs to happen?
Well, I think you can distinguish between communities that talk about mental health, talk about eating disorders, talk about body dysmorphia, and do it in a constructive and supportive way, and those that are just deepening the problem. I've done some research myself on the way that eating disorder and body dysmorphia content manifests on social media platforms. And there is a difference, and you can, not to say it's clear cut in every single case, but you can largely tell the stuff that is going to deepen someone's problems and the stuff which is actually perhaps going to help them. In terms of the role of tech, well, what we're saying on this report is, you know, yes, of course, this, you know, misogyny is a wider social problem. What happens in online communities is that you can end up with these communities that are constructed in a very deliberate way to sort of deepen the most extreme possible views. And the problem is that tech, you know, it connects us all, which is great, but that can also lead to problems, because it can mean that someone who would never in the past have been connected up with, you know, such extreme views and misogyny can now, through a concern about their mental health or about their body image, can end up there quite easily through social media. So to give a couple of examples from our report, we discovered that there are YouTube channels promoting the incel ideology, which are referenced frequently on the incel forum itself, that have 136 subscribers in total, and their videos have been viewed something like 24 million times. That's on YouTube. You know, and what we're trying to make a case to tech here is to say, look, this is really dangerous ideology that you know young people could become exposed to here. It's dangerous to them in terms of the damage it could do further to their mental health and their outlook on life, and it's dangerous to those around them in that it promotes violence, abuse of women in particular. So we want them to sort of take the front foot on this, especially on incel ideology where it's so extreme, and in effect deplatform those channels in the case of YouTube. But we also looked at Google, where with a couple of exceptions, these incelosphere sites rank very, very high for some of the search terms connected with concerns about body image or connected with suicide and mental health. And we would just make a case again, you know, de-rank them. You know, these are known to be harmful sites. You know, members of that suicide forum, for example, have, you know, encouraged others to kill themselves, and the instructions on there have led to the deaths of dozens of young people. There's a very clear case in terms of reducing harm to just de-rank those sites. So I think that's the sort of role that tech can play here. I mean, you know, to be clear, you know, these communities used to exist on Reddit and largely don't anymore in terms of incel communities, although the true story is a little bit complicated, as there are a couple of subreddits which discuss incel communities in a sort of secondary way. So, you know, we accept that in terms of incel communities, it's largely these sort of independent sites, but mainstream platforms have a role in trying to reduce the pathways in there. And just to go back again, I mean, I've done this research previously on body dysmorphia, on eating disorders, on mental health, and the sort of content that's recommended by platforms. We know, as you mentioned, Molly Russell and the inquest there, we know that social media can play a significant role in those harms. It can effectively accelerate it by the content that it will present to young users who, you know, through the content that they view and like, express a sort of interest or concern with issues like body image. So they can also bear down on this problem just by solving these other problems that we know are out there on body image, on mental health, that we know are affecting young users.
It's a very interesting point, I think, that the communities are constructed to deepen the sense of isolation. And I'm fascinated by the use of language, the role of language in that, the way that women are referred to as feminoids or foids and toilets. And as you said, the black pill, red pill discourse and rage fuel. It's very culty. And you can imagine that once you get sucked in, you feel that you're part of a system that other people don't understand. And it's very self-reinforcing.
Absolutely. It's a very active and creative community in terms of its invention of language and new terms. It's almost sort of kaleidoscopic in nature. It's constantly evolving. And it is part of this, they get a thrill out of developing a language that quote-unquote normies, which is used to refer to normal people outside of the incel community as they see them, don't understand and is exclusive to them. And of course, if you know, become an observer of the community or a member of the community, it's part of what binds you is this sort of shared language, a secret language, a language which, you know, they often take pleasure from the fact that, you know, once you know the meaning of the language, it's extremely degrading to women. It's extremely encouraging of violence. But the you know, in their view, the joke is on the normies. You know, they don't understand what's actually under discussion. You know, things like putting brackets in a video game after some statement which you know, espouses violence against women or is a claim about desiring to commit a mass shooting. You know, there's a sense of taking pleasure out of the idea that others are not going to understand what you're talking about. Another one is, you know, you've mentioned all the degrading terms for women. Foids is probably the sort of, you know, one of the ones that's most unique to incels and is sort of short for, you know, female humanoid. And it's just this idea that women aren't even really human in the same way that men are. There's lots of references to mass shooters as well. So, you know, probably the best known in incel mass killer is Elliot Rodger from the US, and they will often insert his initials ER capitalized into other words to sort of be an oblique reference to him, and he's probably the most sort of famed and lauded on the forum in terms of incel mass shooters. So yeah, it's there, it's very deliberate, and it's part of what sort of binds them together, and it's part of you know, the way that they carry out their, you know, and develop their ideology, which is extremely degrading to women and justifies extreme violence.
It is just, I don't know what the word is. I was going to say extraordinary, and that doesn't feel like quite the right word, but it is awful, horrifying. I guess. Horrifying. But there's an element of creativity in that, isn't it? Developing that language and those techniques is quite creative. And I find myself wondering why on earth people who can do that decide to direct it towards something so dark and bleak and negative and awful. Something must have gone deeply wrong.
It's a very determined effort over a series of time. I think there's 17,000 members of the forum, so you know it is a fairly large community that is actually engaged in the creation of content and is constantly iterating upon it. And you know, let's not get carried away. Most of the posts on there are just garbage, right? I mean, they valorize the idea of you know, just posting, you know, in common with some other communities online. They love the idea of just constantly posting and constantly sort of developing this stuff and constantly trying to be as you know, controversial and outrageous as possible. And over time, it sort of leads to the incremental developments of this stuff. I think probably one of the, and there's a lot of sort of, you get the sense there's a lot of sort of pent up, there is a lot of pent up rage and despair there, and they're trying to find some sort of creative outlet for it or some expression for it. It's just, you know, as I've said all along, you know, the concern is that the form of expression that they're taking is contributing to the development of an ideology that justifies extreme violence against women and others. And there's another concern here, which we didn't cover too much in the report, but is definitely there and links to why we decided to investigate this. It's had a, you know, it's part of a wider collaboration in what's called the Manosphere on the sort of terminology and ideological framework of a sort of new misogyny. Stuff like the idea of a Chad and a Stacey. A Chad being a sort of top grade man who has lots of sexual partners, is extremely physically attractive and intelligent and has a great job. And I believe it's a Stacey is his female equivalent. That's the sort of, that's some of the language that's in very regular use on these forums as well. And has seen much wider usage now. You know, it's not uncommon to see it in memes and in social media content and in YouTube videos from influencers and so on, far outside of this core sort of manosphere and definitely far outside of incel communities. And so, you know, they sort of delight in developing this stuff and then see it, you know, take root elsewhere as well.
Yes, and there's a kind of racism, I think, in all of this, which is very similar to the fury that you describe at older women for not sleeping with these people because they're not Stacey's. And there's an assumption that black women also aren't Stacey's. It's very racist in its outlook. I wanted to take you on to talk about the effects on women. And not long ago, you produced a report on misogyny, which was a very different piece of work, I think, because it focused tightly on five women in the public eye, and they were all recipients of abuse. And you found that Instagram failed to act on 90% of the abuse that was suffered by these women, particularly coming through their direct messages. And I wondered why that was and what you learned from that.
Well, we've done a lot of work on, you know, when content, whether it's racist abuse or whether it's very clear and harmful disinformation, when that stuff is reported to a platform and the platform says it's against their standards, how often do they actually act on it? So we've done that work already with respect to misogyny. in terms of public abuse on Twitter and Instagram. And what we heard in the process was, you know, through our contacts, that this was an even more extreme problem when it comes to direct messages, which by their nature are private. That there's a lot of abuse sent over direct message, that there's a lot of sexual images sent over direct message as well, which is called image abuse. And so we set out to investigate it. It's a very hard thing to investigate because you've got to work with people who are receiving this abuse and get access to their inbox effectively. And we were lucky enough to establish some relationships with a number of women public figures, including Rachel Riley and Amber Heard, and have a look at the sort of stuff that they were receiving and then see what the problems were with the practical problems were with reporting it, and then seeing how the platforms actually acted on content when it was reported to them. And what we found was it was sort of even worse rate of action than the public content. And there were some really just basic practical problems in terms of getting the content reported. Clear example, Instagram would effectively require you to look at sexual images sent to you before you could report them, which just is extremely foolish. You know, and means that you effectively have to sort of allow the abuse to take place in its fullest form before you can report someone who's sort of sending you these messages. But there were lots of examples of that in our report. You know, we feel it's been really neglected, and we want the platforms to do better. They're making very, very incremental progress in terms of changing the way that DMs work, but some of the sort of basic stuff we were looking at was just sort of creating a greater presumption against letting strangers just get in touch with public figures with any old abuse. The way Instagram's sort of set up at the moment is it's got something called a sort of message requests inbox, which is supposed to be a home for effectively messages from strangers. But it works in virtually the same way as your core inbox. Those messages come in there, they're just in a different tab. So we think really, especially for, you know, accounts of women public figures, it should be an option, or it should be a sort of a default that strangers can't just send you messages like that, that they need to sort of ask permission in a more sort of robust way.
It does actually, when you describe it, I mean, it just sounds utterly bizarre, doesn't it, that we're in a situation where strangers can send messages, and furthermore, that as a recipient, you have to look at them before you can report them, and even then, there's a fairly high chance that nothing's going to happen. It kind of beggars belief, really. And I want to touch on another report that you did, because taken together, these two pieces of research point us to the issues around context and volume as being the problem, that it's this accumulation of massive amounts of content that take us to difficulties. The work that you did on vaccine disinformation during the pandemic, which I think found 12 anti-vaxxers, 12, were responsible for almost two-thirds of anti-vaccine content. And, you know, all of this adds up to very significant revenues, at least 36 million, worth 1.1 billion. I've got, you know, estimates put it out for big tech. So I think you've come up with something called the STAR framework as a way of addressing it. Can you explain a bit about that for us?
So the STAR framework we've come up with is stands for safety by design, transparency, accountability, and responsibility. And that's a lot of territory to cover. So I'll talk about a couple of them and refer back to some of the things we've discussed. So what we're talking about in terms of safety by design is what I just described in terms of Instagram direct messages. That if someone, certain types of message like images, you've got to actually have a look at them first before you can report them. That's an unsafe design because we know that high profile women will receive lots of graphic sexual content in the form of images sent by strangers into their direct messages inbox. So requiring users to look at it first, that's unsafe by design. So that's really an ask for platforms when they're developing new features and so on to have safety in mind. And if a new feature would cause big safety issues, that's a big reason not to implement it. And then we've got transparency. You just referred to our work on anti-vax. You know, it's remarkably hard to answer some really simple questions about anti-vax during the pandemic. You know, what is the most popular anti-vax content on Facebook? Which anti-vaxxer is the most popular or gets the most reach or gets the most views on Instagram? These are really basic questions about what is going on platforms. And social media companies sometimes like to say, you know, we're a public square, we're part of the public conversation. Well, we're sort of challenging them on the transparency thing. Well, prove it. You know, it's very hard to have a sort of informed public conversation about what's going on social media platforms when you can't answer basic questions like what is the most popular content on Facebook on any given day, or, you know, who are the most influential posters of content about an election or about vaccines or, you know, about LGBTQ issues, you know, take your pick. That's where we at the moment have to step in and hold them accountable. You know, we have to do a bit of work to show, well, here's a problem, here's what it looks like. It often, it involves having to come up with a methodology on how we're going to get that data and how we're going to get some sort of insight into it. So that's the sort of framework that we're asking for. The Online Safety Bill in the UK ticks a lot of those boxes. So it's got a presumption that platforms will have to consider safety by design when they're designing their new features or rolling out new ways of communicating to their users. We've got transparency, and the new regulator Ofcom will be able to require transparency reports from the biggest platforms, so we get more of an insight into the harms that are on there and what's going on. And accountability and responsibility comes from being able to hold them accountable if they refuse or ignore these sort of duties on them to keep their users safe and be more honest and transparent with their users. So the Online Safety Bill, for example, would introduce fines and other penalties for social media companies in the extreme case that they actually deliberately try to mislead the regulator and effectively don't play ball. So that's the sort of framework we're going for. Until then, you know, we've got to do our research and try and make a case for platforms to do more, make a case for legislation like the Online Safety Bill, which stands a chance of fixing these problems. And that's why we did research like our work on anti-vax. Big problem, real harm being caused. And what we try to do is just show that there are sort of concrete, understandable parts of these problems that can be dealt with, that it's not a totally unmanageable, crazy, impossible to understand thing. You know, sometimes parts of these problems are intelligible and you can deal with them. Anti-vax, it's a social phenomenon, of course, and there's people out there who'll be anti-vax whatever happens. But we were trying to make the argument with the report you referred to. Look, there's just a small number of people out there who have an outsized influence in producing and sharing anti-vax content. And just the final thing I'll say as well, I'm really glad you brought up the issue of, you know, the business model almost of these platforms and the money to be made. What you've got to remember is every user and the time that they spend on a platform is money to these platforms. So what they want is users to sign up, and once they're signed up, visit the app or visit the platform as often as possible so that they can be shown as many ads as possible so the platform can earn as much ad revenue as possible. So one thing we often try to sort of remind people is, look, you know, by hosting this awful content, the platform is in effect making money off that content. It is taking a slice of ad revenue from all the user minutes, hours, days, years of time in sum total that are spent looking at that content.
That's fascinating. And you would think that if there were only 12 accounts responsible for most of the anti-vax content, it would be relatively easy to deal with. But it appears that it's not at all, because, as you say, it's very lucrative. I was interested in what you said about the online safety bill ticking a lot of boxes, because that leads me very nicely to the last question we wanted to ask you, which is about the online safety bill, which is currently stalled and which it's not clear at the time of recording the new government may decide to amend, has said that it's thinking of dropping the legal but harmful designation that would deal with hate speech against adults. So I wondered, as the Centre for Countering Digital Hate, whether you're concerned that this government is abandoning the fight against hate, or whether in fact you think that there might be a better way to do it that doesn't focus so much on content and does focus more on the kind of things that you're talking about with the STAR framework that wouldn't require that designation? Or do we need that designation?
Just to get out of the way, fundamentally, we support this bill. We think it's going to be a sort of significant improvement on what we've got at the moment, which is nothing, or is sort of self-regulation of the platforms, which, as our research shows time and again, the platforms don't act. You know, when we need them to act, they're not on top of hate and disinformation. They're not on top of safety. They're not on top of children's safety in the way that we need them to be. So fundamentally, we back it. In terms of what the government's going to do next, I mean, we understand they are going to bring it back. There's this question mark over the what is sometimes referred to as legal but harmful content. Now, a really important thing to just be clear about here is the duties on this, I would just call it harmful content, which doesn't constitute, you know, existing illegal sort of criminal activity. The duties are actually almost entirely around transparency. It's all about being more honest with your users about what your standards are on that harmful content. And we're talking stuff like self-harm, content that encourages body dysmorphia and eating disorders, content which is sort of clear harmful health disinformation. That's the sort of stuff we're talking about. And the duties there are actually just around transparency, setting standards, being honest with your users about the standards, being honest about what you do when something breaches the standards. And we support that. And, you know, I think one of the most interesting arguments I heard put forward on this is actually by Five Rights, which is another organisation in our space that focuses on children's safety online in particular. And they say, look, you can't just have this walled garden for children on the internet. You know, young users, I grew up with the internet. So, you know, I know firsthand, young users are often more adept than their parents. And they will find ways to access adult content in the end anyway. So you've got to actually address the adult content, the wider pool of harmful content, if you truly want to make the internet safer and social media platforms safer for younger users and children as well, because they're going to encounter it at some point. And you can't just hope to sort of, it's not possible to hive off this little corner of the internet where you say, well, that's safe for children now. That's not really how the internet works. Just look at our report that we've been discussing here with incels. The whole issue is that, you know, through something as innocuous as a search on Google or stumbling across something on YouTube, a young user could encounter something which leads them into this rabbit hole that terminates in joining the incel forum and adopting this really extreme ideology. So we really support the online safety bill. We really hope that there's something in there about this requirements for greater transparency and honesty with users about harmful content that affects adults as well. But either way, it's going to be a massive step forward, because at the moment there just is no transparency, accountability or duty to keep users safe. And that's what the online safety bill should do.
That has been an absolutely fascinating discussion. Thank you so much. I feel for the purposes of balance, as an organisation that also works with some of the big platforms, they would argue that maintaining trust amongst their users is really important, and they invest heavily in safety and safety tools. And I think there is that side of the equation as well. But clearly, your report highlights so brilliantly, there are enormous problems that are still flourishing in plain sight. And it's been absolutely fascinating hearing about them. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We know platforms are, you know, try to make progress on this stuff, and we hope that our work is a sort of constructive contribution in terms of highlighting where the problems are. And I'm really grateful for you inviting us on so we can talk about some of those problems.
So that was an interesting lesson.
I think it was quite a difficult listen. I don't remember any of our podcasts being quite as unremittingly dark as the world that Callum has just described.
No, and I do find that contradiction between the creativity of the language and the sort of innovative quality of the world, the inventiveness, and the nihilistic hatred really perplexing. Very interesting, but completely perplexing, because if there's that much energy in it, you would think that they wouldn't be so negative.
Yeah, it was interesting, wasn't it? And that purposeful recruitment of vulnerable people through other forums that those guys had set up, thinking about anorexia and suicide and self-harm, that incredibly targeted and deliberate focus on people who feel marginalized and on the edges of society. It's just cynical and really deeply unpleasant.
It is really horrible. And Callum seemed to suggest that the founders of that platform were true believers. But it does, as you say, seem really cynical and calculated. And that's quite difficult to square with being a true believer. But perhaps they're such true believers that they want everybody to believe.
Yes, and I do wonder about that. I wonder if those two guys who are pulling the strings, I mean, you know, Callum is the expert here, but I wonder where that balance of cynicism and true belief actually lies, and, you know, where it takes us, whether this seemingly growing trend of real misogyny and unpleasantness online is the direction of travel, or do we at some point see a turn to something more positive and optimistic? Can we deal with these horrible communities?
It's a very good question, and it does seem, as a woman listening to this, very depressing and upsetting. So let's hope we can.
And I suppose, to leave our listeners with a slightly more optimistic note, next week we have Sam Gilbert, who
yes.
will be talking to us about the internet of the future. And let's hope it's a better internet than the one that we've heard described today. You've been listening to Tech Shock from Parents Own with Vicky Shotbolt and Geraldine Bedell. We hope you'll sign up for regular episodes wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to give us a rating, preferably a good one, so other people can be helped to find us.